Welcome to Base by Base, the podcast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine this, a single tiny change in your genetic code, and suddenly it's affecting your eyes, your metabolism, your muscles, maybe even your kidneys all at once. How could one small error cause such widespread problems? And what does it tell us about how our bodies, you know, how our cells actually work together? Today, we're doing a deep dive into these syndromic diseases. These are complex conditions where just one gene mutation can lead to this, well, surprising mix of seemingly unrelated symptoms across different parts of the body. It's a huge puzzle for doctors trying to diagnose them, but figuring out the genetic root cause, that can be genuinely transformative. So get ready, because we're about to explore some really surprising connections inside our own biology. And today, we really want to highlight the incredible work done by Anneke T. Wolttewan-Sofoudt and her, well, massive international team. Their research, mainly coming out of Radboud University Medical Center in the Netherlands, but involving collaborators from 11 other centers worldwide, has really pushed forward our understanding of these multi-organ conditions called ciliopathies.
It really is impressive work, and it tackles a major challenge in genetic diagnosis. See, previously, there was this specific genetic issue, a homozygous loss-of-function variant in a gene called POC5, and for a long time, it was pretty much just linked to retinitis pigmentosa, you know, RP, that inherited eye disease that causes progressive vision loss.
Right, so it was basically seen as an eye problem. What were the first hints that maybe POC5 was doing more than just affecting vision?
Well, even in the very early reports, just single cases, the individuals with these POC5 variants, they showed other things too. Symptoms like short stature, sometimes microcephaly, that's a smaller size kidney problems, even muscle pain. So these extra symptoms immediately made people wonder, could POC5 actually be involved in a much wider range of bodily functions?
Okay, yeah, that definitely changes the picture. So what exactly is POC5? Why am I to have these far-reaching effects?
So POC5 codes for a protein that's found in centrioles. Centrioles are these like core structures inside our cells, really important for cell division and organization. But the key thing here is that POC5 is also absolutely crucial for something called the basal body of primary cilia.
Primary cilia. Okay, I feel like these are going to be important. Remind us what they are.
Oh, absolutely vital. Primary cilia are like tiny antennae sticking out from almost all of our cells. Think of them as little sensors. They play a huge role in how cells communicate, how they sense what's going on around them. And when the proteins that build or operate these cilia get disrupted, that's when you get this whole group of disorders we call ciliopathies.
Ciliopathies. Mm. And if these cellular antennas aren't working right, what kind of problems pop up?
It's incredibly varied, actually. Ciliopathies are really diverse, clinically speaking. They can affect almost any organ system. But you often see things like retinal degeneration, like the RP we mentioned, kidney problems, sometimes obesity, skeletal issues too. The fact that POC5 is involved with cilia immediately put it in that category, but nobody really knew the full extent of it.
So with all these other symptoms cropping up, kidney issues, muscle pain, the idea that POC5 only caused eye problems was looking, well, a bit shaky. Mm-hmm. How did this study try to get the bigger picture?
Exactly. The evidence was really pointing towards a much broader effect. The technical term is pleiotropic, meaning one gene affecting multiple traits, way beyond just the eyes. It strongly suggested POC5 was linked to a whole systemic disorder. So this study, the one we're talking about today, aimed to really map out that full spectrum of effects and also figure out the molecular nuts and bolts behind it, moving from just the eye condition to understanding the whole interconnected syndrome. Right, so to really define this wider picture, the researchers gathered a group, a cohort of 12 families. And the key thing was that individuals in these families all had biallelic loss of function POC5 variants.
Biallelic meaning they got one faulty copy of the gene from each parent, right? Two hits.
That's exactly it. And these families were from all over the place, diverse ethnic backgrounds, different countries, which is super important to see if the condition looks the same everywhere. Finding them involved a lot of international teamwork, using databases like GeneMatcher and networks like the European Retinal Disease Consortium. It really shows how global science needs to be for rare diseases. Okay, so once they had the families, the next big step was what they called a phenotype deep dive, basically meticulously collecting all the clinical details. They gathered retrospective data, so looking back at medical histories covering everything, eyes, hormones, other body systems, all using standardized questionnaires to keep the information consistent. This let them build a really complete picture for each person, way beyond just the eye symptoms.
And confirming the genetics. How did they pin down that POC5 was definitely the cause in these families?
They used the big guns exome or genome sequencing to read the participants' genetic code and spot the POC5 variants. Then, crucially, they did segregation analysis using other sequencing methods. This means checking within the families, do the affected people have the two POC5 variants, and do the unaffected family members not have them, or only have one? It confirms the link between the gene variant and the condition.
Okay, so they found the gene variants,
yeah.
But did they check if these variants actually messed up the gene's function? Like at the RNA level?
Yes, that was a key part. They looked at RNA from cell lines derived from some of the participants, fibroblasts usually from skin samples. The main goal was to see if these variants actually led to less POC5 gene expression, less of the POC5 message being made. And they found, often, that the variants caused the cell's quality control system, something called nonsense-mediated decay, or NMD, to destroy the faulty RNA message. This confirmed these were truly loss-of-function variants. The cell just wasn't making enough working POC5 protein. They even had one really interesting case, participant P3, where the variant created a totally new, wrong splice site in the RNA, leading to a messed-up non-functional protein.
Wow. Okay, so the gene code was wrong, the RNA message was getting destroyed or messed up.
Yeah.
What about the actual cells? Did the cilia look different or act differently?
That's where the imaging came in immunofluorescence. They use those fibroblast cells again. They use specific antibodies to basically light up where the POC5 protein was supposed to be, and also a related protein called centrin. They could also check if cilia were forming okay, measure how long they were, and even test the function of a key signaling pathway that uses cilia. The sonic hedgehog pathway. It let them see the direct cellular impact.
Right, let's get into the results then. First off, the genetics. What did they find across these 12 families?
So they confirmed the biallelic POC5 loss of function variants in all 12 families. 11 families had homozygous variants, same faulty copy from both parents, and one had compound heterozygous variants, two different faulty copies. They identified 10 distinct variants in total. Interestingly, some of these variants popped up in unrelated families from different ethnic backgrounds, and here's a critical point. None of these homozygous loss-of-function variants were found in the huge public databases of healthy populations, like NOAMD. That really hammers home how rare they are and how likely they are to cause disease when someone has two copies.
That rarity definitely points to pathogenicity. Okay, now for the main event, the full phenotypic spectrum, all the health problems they found. This is where that complex puzzle starts to take shape, right? What symptoms made up this syndrome?
It was a really striking and surprisingly consistent picture across the different families, a true multi-organ syndrome. Now, as expected, almost everyone, 11 out of 12 participants, had rod cone dystrophy, the RCD. Typically started in their teens with night blindness, losing peripheral vision, progressive stuff. One participant, P3, actually had a much more severe early onset form with nystagmus, the involuntary eye movements. But crucially, it was so much more than just an eye disease.
Okay, so beyond the vision loss, what else was consistently showing up?
Well, the metabolic side was really prominent. 10 participants developed diabetes, usually quite young. Median age was only 26. And this wasn't your standard type 2 diabetes. It featured really high insulin resistance. You could see it high insulin levels in their blood. Signs like acanthosis nigricans, skin darkening, and fatty liver disease. And then there was this really unusual finding, especially for a ciliopathy, partial lipodystrophy in 6 of them.
Lipodystrophy? Loss of fat?
Yeah, but specifically partial. They lost the subcutaneous fat from their arms, legs, face, giving them this kind of slim, muscular look, but they actually accumulated fat in their abdomen and sometimes neck. It's quite counterintuitive. They generally had low BMI, average around 19, but metabolically they were quite unhealthy with the insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. Participant P10 was apparently a very striking example. And alongside this, many also had reproductive issues, particularly the females' irregular periods, ovarian cysts, signs of high male hormones.
Wow, that's a complex metabolic picture.
Yeah.
What about the muscles and kidneys you mentioned earlier?
Also very common. 10 participants had neuromuscular problems. 8 of them reported having these really painful intermittent muscle cramps, often starting way back in childhood. Some also have muscle weakness and elevated levels of creatine kinase, or CK, in their blood, which indicates muscle damage. There was even a suspicion of rhabdomyolysis, severe muscle breakdown in one participant, P5, who sadly actually died from acute pancreatitis, which can sometimes be linked to severe metabolic issues or medications. And kidney disease was there too. 4 participants had renal insufficiency, 1 needed a transplant. And disturbingly, there was a family pattern in two cases, P2 and P6, where siblings had also died young from kidney failure. Really highlights the severity. So you put it all together, the severe eye disease, the complex diabetes and lipodystrophy, the muscle cramps, the kidney risk, it paints a very clear picture of a widespread multisystem disorder.
Were there any other features that seemed common across the group?
Yes, definitely. Pretty much all participants had relatively short stature compared to their families. Some had smaller head circumference, the microcephaly. There were also some shared subtle facial features, things like a wide base of the nose, maybe a prominent lower jaw, large ears, and then things like sparse hair or actual hair loss, alopecia, and some skin abnormalities were noted. A couple even had scoliosis, curvature of the spine. It all reinforces that this isn't just a random collection of symptoms. It's an interconnected syndrome stemming from that single gene defect.
Okay, so they mapped out this complex clinical syndrome. What did the cell studies tell them about how the POC5 mutation was causing all this disruption? What was happening inside the cells?
Yeah, the cellular work provided some really crucial clues about the mechanism. Using that immunofluorescence technique on the fibroblasts, they saw that the POC5 protein itself wasn't where it was supposed to be. In control cells, you see it clearly at the centrioles. But in the participant cells, the signal was either missing or much, much weaker. It wasn't localizing correctly. And did that affect anything else around the centrioles? It did. It seemed to mess up the localization of centrin, which is a protein that normally binds to POC5. Instead of seeing neat, distinct spots of centrin where you'd expect them, the signal was kind of diffuse, spread out. So it suggests that when POC5 isn't in the right place, it disrupts the organization of other important proteins around it.
So a fundamental problem with organizing that centriolar area. But what about the cilia themselves? Did they look okay? Were they forming?
This was interesting. For most participants, the overall number or percentage of cells forming cilia seemed pretty similar to the controls. So ciliogenesis itself wasn't grossly impaired in most cases. However, in that one participant, P3, the one with the more severe eye disease, their fibroblasts showed cilia that were mildly but significantly shorter than controls. It raises some really interesting questions, like why only that participant showed shorter cilia, and does that somehow relate to their more severe phenotype? Still some unknowns there.
And what about that signaling pathway you mentioned, the sonic hedgehog pathway? Was its function affected by the faulty cilia?
Also quite interesting, that pathway seemed to be working okay, functions normally in the participant cells they tested. And that's an important detail. It tells us that even though POC5 is crucial for the basal body, its loss doesn't necessarily break all ciliary functions. It suggests POC5 might have quite specific roles, and maybe its disruption affects certain ciliary tasks or signals more than others. It's not a complete shutdown of the cilium.
Right, so we have the clinical picture, we have some cellular clues, but maybe the most important part is what this all means for patients, right? How does this change things in the clinic? And one of the really striking things was that many of these people went undiagnosed for years, or were only diagnosed when their eye problems became severe. Even though, looking back, they'd had other major symptoms, like the diabetes or muscle cramps, sometimes since childhood.
So the diagnosis was often missed or delayed because the symptoms seemed unconnected. Exactly. Which points to a really critical diagnostic need. The study basically says, look, if you see a patient with early onset type 2 diabetes, especially with signs of insulin resistance, or if they show signs of lipodystrophy, or have these unexplained muscle cramps or kidney issues, you should really consider testing for POC5 variants, even if their vision seems okay at that point. Getting that diagnosis earlier could make a massive difference to how their health is managed.
Okay, that makes sense. Connect the dots earlier. Now, thinking about those connections, how much do the diabetes and lipodystrophy explain the other symptoms? Are things like the kidney problems just secondary effects?
That's a great question. Certainly some things, like the fatty liver or maybe the hyperandrogenism in females, could well be secondary consequences of the severe insulin resistance and altered fat metabolism. But, and this is important, the kidney problems and the muscle cramps often seemed more severe than you'd typically expect just from diabetes or lipodystrophy alone. This hints that POC5 dysfunction might be having a more direct primary impact in the kidneys and muscles too, not just indirectly via the metabolic chaos.
So, given this whole complex picture, what are the actual recommendations now for managing people identified with these POC5 variants?
Well, the understanding of the full syndrome leads to pretty clear management guidelines. The study recommends yearly screening for cardiovascular risk factors. That means checking blood pressure, lipids, blood sugar, insulin levels. Also, regular checks on liver and kidney function through blood tests, probably liver imaging too, like an ultrasound, to monitor for fatty liver, and checking those CK levels for muscle damage. And because the metabolic issues, particularly the lipodystrophy, are quite specific, they suggest referring patients to specialist centers that deal with lipodystrophy. There's even a specific treatment, recombinant human metreleptin, that might be considered for the really tough metabolic problems, though that needs expert guidance. It's really about proactive, comprehensive, multi-system care.
Okay, stepping back a bit. Why does messing up this one protein, POC5, cause problems in so many different places? Eyes, metabolism, muscle, kidney. What's the underlying reason for this pleiotropy?
The main reason is probably just that POC5 is expressed pretty much everywhere in the body. It's not limited to just one tissue type. If a protein has a fundamental role in basic cell structures, like centrioles and cilia, which most cells have, then disrupting it is likely to cause ripples across many systems. And we see hints of this in animal models, too. Mice engineered to lack POC5 show problems in various systems, reproductive, endocrine, neurological, even if their eye phenotype isn't exactly the same as in humans. So the widespread expression is key.
And where does this specific POC5 syndrome fit within the bigger world of ciliopathies? You mentioned lipodystrophy was unusual.
Yes, that's one of the most fascinating aspects of this work, how it expands our view of ciliopathies, the retinal problems, the kidney issues. Those fit quite well with what we already know about other ciliopathies, their common features. But the partial lipodystrophy, that was really a novel finding for this class of disorders. It sparks this really interesting hypothesis. Maybe primary cilia play a role in how fat cells, adipocytes, develop and function. Perhaps disruptions in cilia during adipogenesis, the process of making fat cells, could directly lead to lipodystrophy. We do see some related metabolic issues like insulin resistance or different patterns of fat distribution in other ciliopathies like Bardet-Biedl syndrome or Alström syndrome. But this specific type of partial lipodystrophy seems new for the group.
That's a really cool potential link. Are there other genes or syndromes that help support this idea of cilia being involved in fat metabolism?
Absolutely. The similarities between this POC5 syndrome and Alström syndrome are quite striking. And guess what? The gene causing Alström, ALMS1, also codes for a protein found at centrioles and basal bodies, another link. Plus, there are other related POC proteins. POC1A causes something called Softay syndrome, which explicitly includes insulin resistance and central obesity. And POC1B, which was initially thought to be mainly eye-related, is now increasingly being linked to kidney disease and diabetes too. So yeah, there's this growing family of conditions linked to these centrioles ciliary proteins, all showing overlapping features, especially involving metabolism, kidneys, and eyes. It really strengthens the connection.
So bringing it all together, what's the big take-home message for everyone listening?
I think the core message is that this deep dive reveals how disrupting just one gene, POC5, causes a complex, previously underappreciated syndrome. It's not just eye disease. It's severe retinal degeneration, plus major metabolic problems like diabetes and this unusual lipodystrophy, plus kidney failure risk, plus those debilitating muscle cramps. And critically, all these diverse problems seem to be tied together by the common thread of faulty cilia function. It really highlights the profound interconnectedness of our body systems right down to the cellular level. And practically, it gives us real, actionable knowledge for better diagnosis and more comprehensive care for people affected by these tough conditions.
Right. This deep dive has clearly shown that biallelic loss of function variants in the POC5 gene cause a previously underrecognized multi-organ syndrome, encompassing severe retinal degeneration, complex metabolic disturbances like diabetes with insulin resistance, and partial lipodystrophy, kidney failure, and debilitating muscle cramps. Critically, these diverse symptoms are interconnected through their shared link to ciliary dysfunction. So the final thought to leave you with is this. What does this expanded understanding mean for how we approach diagnostic challenges when we see clusters of seemingly unrelated symptoms? And how might this knowledge guide us toward more integrated and ultimately more effective treatments for people living with rare genetic conditions? This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and license in our episode description. If you enjoy this analysis, the best way to support Base by Base is to subscribe or follow in your favorite podcast app and leave us a 5-star rating. It only takes a few seconds, but makes a huge difference in helping others discover the show. Thanks for listening. And join us next time as we explore more science, Base by Base.